Well, those of you who were at my talk last week know that I was applying incredibly complicated techniques, supersymmetry and so on, to a very simple problem of electrons in a magnetic field. So since I'm a person of extremes, I'm now going to swing to the other side and use very simple arguments to try to understand something about an incredibly complicated system, which is the Earth's climate. Okay, so I've actually added two words to my title. It's really the quantum and wave mechanics of global warming. And I have three examples which I'm going to draw from quantum mechanics that play a crucial role in our understanding of global warming. And is there a pointer here? The first one has to do with simply Planck's black body radiation, which I'm going to give you a sort of ahistorical review of. And we're going to use that to make a very simple estimate of the Earth's temperature. And we're going to decide that we should be really freezing if that were the whole story, and of course it isn't. So then I'm going to elaborate on that story using some other ideas from quantum mechanics, very simple ideas. And then I'll actually deviate a little bit from my title and get into some astronomy and also some wave mechanics to look at the recent and distant past to try to decipher the historical record of climate change. And finally, I'll conclude with some comments on the politics of global warming. So, of course, climate change really is an incredibly broad area. At least all of these hard sciences are included, not to mention all the soft sciences of sociology and so on. And I'm going to be mainly focusing on physics, since I'm a physicist, and present my perspective on this, but also some astronomy and a little bit of some of these other things. And in physics, of course, there's really two ways that this has something to say about global warming. One is through very simple, basic equations, basic understandings, basic estimates, which is what I'm going to be talking about today, and also as input for the construction of these incredibly complicated computer models for global circulation, which I won't have much to say at all about. Okay, so the problem of climate is extremely complicated because it involves a huge range of both temporal and spatial scales, and it has sort of a cartoon picture taken from a nice book called The Physics of Climate, which illustrates something about the temporal scales that are involved, starting from periods of order billions of years corresponding to the age of the Earth, all the way down to, well, really, to seconds, if we want to go all the way down to turbulent scales. So this will give us some overview of some of the timescales we're going to be looking at. First of all, we have this timescale involving continental drift, the breakup of Pangaea, and you know, the large-scale motion of the land masses around the Earth. Then a timescale of on the order of tens of million years is associated with mountain building, for example, the uplift of the Himalayas, which had a big effect on the Earth's climate. And then there's some interesting structure here. This is supposed to be this vertical scale, just some sort of scale of importance of the these timescales on the Earth's climate. Some interesting peaks here, which we'll have quite a bit more to say about later on. Let's skip over those for right now. So those are at timescales of 100,000, 40,000, and 20,000 years. Then there's the so-called climate optimum, on the order of a few thousand years, which corresponds to the development of civilization when conditions were particularly favorable for agriculture to develop. Over the past couple hundred years, there was a cool period called the Little Ice Age, when glaciers in California briefly formed again. The glaciers had disappeared at the end of the last ice age, but formed, and they are now rapidly disappearing once again. Well, maybe either. It's a very crude thing. We could take it as fluctuations in temperature. Yeah. we have logarithmic scale in years here, and I mean, this is really, as I say, just a cartoon. It's not really true.
Very, very narrow spike.
Well, okay, so at 1 year, of course, we have a huge spike, a very precise spike, because the Earth's climate changes on a seasonal scale. And there's harmonics. There's harmonics at 6 months and so on. Okay. The vertical scale is just way to kind of roughly characterize the importance of these timescales on, say, the temperature of the Earth. Okay, it's not saying that it was warm here and cold here, but that processes on the order of, say,
yeah.
Pardon? I guess the idea is that we certainly have a very sharp peak at 1 year. this isn't my figure. I don't want to ascribe any particular importance to the height here. It's just saying that this is obviously an important feature. Okay, it's just simply a way of presenting what the important time scales are in the problem. We'll actually look at some honest spectral power plots of some of these features later on. Down here we have some variations on the scale of a few days, which are just usual weather systems passing through synoptic disturbances, and then of course temperature variations on the scale of a day and half a day and so on, the harmonics of the Earth's rotation period. I was trying to remember what that was. I think that has to do with the variations in the lunar orbit over a 27-year period. No, the sunspots would be supposedly here, 10 to 20 years, the 11-year cycle, 22-year cycle of the sun. All right, so let's proceed as a physicist would and try to estimate what the Earth's temperature should be. So I'm going to give you a kind of funny derivation of Planck's black body spectrum. And if we pretend we were living in the 19th century and we didn't know about H-bar, how would we calculate what the temperature is? How would we, in particular, find out how the intensity of some black body varies as a function of temperature and frequency? Well, we know it's some function of the temperature and frequency, but we don't have H-bar around, so we need to construct the correct units. And so we do have Boltzmann's constant, because Boltzmann had already contributed that to molecular theory of gases. So we know that we can convert temperatures to joules. And we have frequencies, which are in units of inverse seconds. We want an intensity, which is going to be watts per meter squared or joules per meter squared per second. So combining all those things, and also, of course, we have the speed of light, which we need, we would get the correct units if we multiply the temperature times Boltzmann's constant times the frequency squared and some interval of frequency that we're integrating over to get our intensity and divide by the speed of light squared. That will give us the speed of light squared, for example, will give us the meters squared down here that we need for our intensity. And of course, a more sophisticated way of deriving this would be to use the equipartition theorem and to say that we have modes in a cavity and each one will assign an energy of order of the temperature, and the number of modes grows as the frequency squared just due to the usual phase space argument. But of course, there's an ultraviolet catastrophe, because if we try to use this formula to compute the total intensity, we find it will diverge because we have an integral that goes like nu squared d nu, integrating up to infinity, this will diverge. So this is the first place where quantum mechanics is going to play a role in our understanding of the Earth's temperature, because we're going to have to use and include another physical constant, which of course is Planck's constant. And of course the famous relationship, which will allow us to construct a more complicated functional form that will interpolate between our result that we just derived, which is applicable at low frequencies, and go to zero at high frequencies, because of course it will be cut off by this exponential. And of course this was the beginning of quantum mechanics, although I was just reading in Thomas Kuhn's book about Planck's discovery that when Planck wrote this down, he was most proud of the fact not that this new constant emerged, but that by fitting this form to the existing experimental data, Boltzmann's constant emerged. And he knew that Boltzmann's constant had already been around, but to see that it had popped out in this new context, the context of light instead of and electromagnetic radiation instead of atoms, was for him something quite moving. Of course, later on, this took greater significance. But at the beginning, when he was constructing his theory, he saw this somehow more as a crutch to put the electromagnetic theory into the framework of molecular statistical mechanics. Okay, so now, of course, there are no ultraviolet catastrophes, so we can integrate over all the frequency, and we'll get the famous Stefan-Boltzmann law that says that the total intensity goes as the temperature to the fourth power, where this Stefan-Boltzmann constant contains factors of the Boltzmann constant and Planck's constant. And just to remind you, of course, the black body spectrum here, theoretical plot at different temperatures, we see that as the temperature increases, each intensity plot always is greater at all wavelengths, all frequencies, than the lower temperature plots, and that we recover Wien's law, which says that as the temperature of our black body increases, the position of the peak intensity shifts to lower and lower wavelengths, higher and higher frequencies. Here's some of the data that Planck originally looked at to decide that there was some deviations from Wien's law decided that his formula actually fit the data better. There was very slight deviations. He was mainly concerned in the infrared. That's where the deviations were occurring because they had already decided that there better be this exponential factor cutting off the ultraviolet catastrophe. And so the problem was to fit actually in the infrared and to get a formula that interpolated correctly. So this is a plot at different temperatures at a fixed wavelength, 51.2 microns, looking at the intensity.
Why did they measure sodium chloride?
I don't know. Yeah. Of course, it's a challenge to get a good ideal black body, and that was one of the big experimental problems, was to get something that was truly black body. In fact, even today, the best black body is not something in the laboratory, but the cosmic microwave background radiation. Here's a plot of the Planck spectrum with the COBE, the results from the COBE satellite as these tiny dots. The errors are quite small. And you can see that that's, in fact, I think this is still the best confirmation of the Planck spectrum. Okay, so let's use that now to calculate the temperature of the Earth. Very simple calculation. We're going to assume equilibrium, that is, the Earth receives as much radiation as it emits. It receives it mainly in the visible wavelengths and emits it mainly in the infrared. So we need to know the temperature of the Sun, which is about 6,000 degrees Kelvin, its diameter, the distance of the Earth from the Sun. And so we can figure out the fraction of the Sun's radiation that's intercepted by the Earth. The Earth presents a disk to the Sun, so we just want the area of a disk of the Earth's radius divided by the area of this huge sphere that encloses the Sun at the Earth's radius, at the distance of the Earth from the Sun. And then we have this correction factor, which includes something called the albedo, which just tells us that some of the Sun's radiation is reflected directly back out into space. Of course, the Earth is quite bright from space. It reflects about 30% of the light, mainly off of the clouds. That's why we can see the dark face of the moon during the new moon. We have the distance from the Sun as an input parameter. And the luminosity of the Sun, we'll just use our Stefan-Boltzmann law. It's the area of the Sun times the Stefan-Boltzmann constant and the temperature to the fourth power. So now we'll just balance those two quantities. Here's the amount intercepted with that factor of the albedo. This is the amount that's radiated back out due to the Earth's temperature, T Earth, And there's, of course, a large number of cancellations. The Stefan Boltzmann constant cancels out, along with all these 4 pis and so on. We ultimately have this formula that just depends on the temperature of the sun and the ratio of the radius of the sun to the distance of the Earth from the sun. And this factor that involves the albedo, but rather weakly, we change that by a small amount, then the correction is quite small because of that factor of 1/4. If we plug in, then we'll get a temperature of the Earth in this very simplified model of about 250 degrees Kelvin, which of course is freezing and not realistic. Okay, so of course there's something left out of all this, and what's left out of that is the atmosphere. So we need to consider the effect of the atmosphere. So here, in a more realistic model, we have our incoming solar radiation with 100 here representing 100%. And we can see how that radiation is divided into the Earth and into the atmosphere. A lot of it is reflected directly back out into space. Here, the albedo would be 30%. I've used the factor of 30. 25 is being reflected off the atmosphere, 5% off the surface. 45% is being absorbed on the surface, 25% is being absorbed directly in the air. There's energy that is transferred back out in the form of evaporation so that the water vapor, which condenses and releases latent heat in the atmosphere, that heat can then go back out into space. There's the direct infrared radiation emitted by the surface, much of which is reflected back down by the clouds, which is why it's warmer on cloudy nights. Some of it goes straight out into space. Some of it is also intercepted by these greenhouse gases, which is going to be, of course, of importance for the rest of the talk. So the principal greenhouse gas is not carbon dioxide, but actually water vapor by a large margin. The carbon dioxide is the second most important. Also, methane and the chlorofluorocarbons are important. Okay, so this is where quantum mechanics is going to enter in the second place, because, of course, in order to understand how those greenhouse gases block the emission of the infrared radiation back out into space, we need to know something about the infrared absorption of these various molecules. And in particular, we're interested in the molecules that have dipole moments, such as the water molecule. So those are the ones that will absorb the most. And we have, of course, these various modes of vibration, also for the carbon dioxide molecule. So, of course, the Planck relation now takes on a very physical significance in the sense that a photon is emitted or absorbed as these molecules make transitions between the various states. Now, we have to, so as I say, that we don't have to worry about molecules such as nitrogen, which don't have a dipole moment. So we're looking at the ones that will have some dipole moment. And if we want to do an accurate calculation, we'll have to account for the pressure and Doppler broadening of these lines, because that will heavily influence the cross-section for the absorption of radiation by these molecules. They're colliding with each other in the atmosphere, broadening the lines out. So instead of going to that calculation, I'm just going to take as empirical input the observed absorption due to these gases in our atmosphere. So here I have a plot of the wavelength, and here are our 2 Planck black body spectra, one for the sun at 6,000 degrees, one for the Earth at the temperature that we calculated for our black body without any atmosphere. And this is the absorption of radiation at the ground level for a typical atmosphere. And you can see that in the visible wavelengths, most of the visible light goes through, but most of the infrared is absorbed, therefore causing this greenhouse effect. And we can break this down into the different constituent gases. Here's water. Water has the most strongest absorption, because it has the highest concentration of the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, but also this has quite a few bands. There's carbon dioxide. This is oxygen, ozone, and some of the trace gases. And we can estimate also the contribution of these to warming up the Earth to the observed temperature, which is around 290 degrees Kelvin. Water contributes about 21 degrees. Carbon dioxide contributes about 7 degrees. So adding those two to our black body temperature, we get something closer to 15 degrees Celsius, which is more realistic. Okay. The internal energy sources from the geothermal heat, for example, that's negligible because the heat, the conductivity of the rock is so low. And the intensity of the solar constant is 1,300 watts per meter squared, so it just overwhelms it. Similarly, the heat output by fossil fuels and nuclear power plants is negligible on these scales when you consider the whole Earth. Okay, so we can actually include those factors. You might wonder how I get those actual temperatures. And there's a nice textbook, maybe some of you know it, called Consider a Spherical Cow, which has really, it's a very nice physics approach to environmental problems by John Hart. And we can make a very simple model that includes some of this atmospheric structure by modeling the atmosphere as or the Earth atmosphere system as the Earth surface plus two layers of atmosphere. Each layer is supposed to completely absorb and then re-emit the infrared radiation going out. All right, so we saw that from that absorption plot that the basically 100% of the infrared radiation is going to be trapped by the greenhouse gases. So to account for that, we'll simply divide up the atmosphere, and it turns out that the appropriate number of layers in this sort of crude model is two. So we have a layer up here, which will assign a temperature T0, which maybe we can think of as being in the stratosphere. Another layer here in the troposphere of temperature T1, and then we have the surface temperature. And then we simply need to balance the heat flux through each of these layers. That's this system of three equations here. We have three equations and three unknowns, T0, T1, and TS. Plus we have these various fluxes, which are due to, besides the fact that we have the greenhouse effect operating, which is absorbing and re-emitting the heat at each one of these interfaces, we also have various other processes which are redistributing the heat. We have the reflection straight out into space by the albedo, which we already talked about. We also have the evaporation of water and the redistribution of that latent heat up into these two layers. We have infrared radiation that's going straight back out, which is rather small. We have convection in this first layer in the form of, say, that's basically the definition of the troposphere versus the stratosphere. The stratosphere is the layer of the atmosphere where there's very little convection. And so forth. These things have been estimated. These are basically the same quantities that appeared on my first transparency in the schematic of the Earth's atmosphere, and we get this higher temperature. Okay, so that's the second place where quantum mechanics came in. And I forgot to mention, when I gave this talk at Brown, with the demo person, have built a demonstration of single photon interference, which I like to use to illustrate the Planck relation. And so I have a this apparatus costs about $100,000, so needless to say I didn't bring it here, especially since I didn't know I was going to be giving this talk. So what happens during the course of the talk is that what we have is a laser that the beam goes through multiple neutral density filters, so it's attenuated down to a few photons per second. And then those photons pass through a two-slit, and then they are recorded in an extremely sensitive photon detector that's built by Hamamatsu. And as the talk progresses, what happens is we see a few photons coming in, and by about now, we start beginning to see an interference pattern. And if that wasn't convincing, then by the end of the talk, we get something like this. And so showing the particle-wave duality. And if you'd like instructions on how to build such a thing, this was done by Lyman Page at Princeton originally. That's where we found out how to get all the necessary ingredients. Okay, so those are two of the ways that quantum mechanics enters into our understanding of climate. So now I'd like to come to the third. And that is, now that we have achieved some crude understanding of the Earth's temperature, I'd now like to look at the historical record to see if we could gain some further understanding of the role of greenhouse gases. So here's a famous plot, maybe many of you have seen this, which is results from the Vostok ice core in Antarctica. And it presents a chronology over the past 160,000 years for the concentration of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere and the temperature of the Earth. And, well, the way that the carbon dioxide concentration can be obtained is rather straightforward. When this ice is trapped in Antarctica, it traps a little bit of the atmosphere into gas bubbles. And, of course, that gas can be analyzed to determine the relative fraction of carbon dioxide compared to the other gases. To get the temperature, though, is rather miraculous. And as I'd now like to show you, the way that this is determined is by looking at changes in the isotope ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16 in water, and that quantum mechanics is the reason why this ratio is expected to change with the temperature. But before I get to that, let's just look at this a little bit more. First of all, it's pretty obvious that there's a very strong correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature. It's not possible from this record to determine which one occurs first, because the temporal resolution is rather crude, on the order of 100 years or so. That's because it precipitates so little in Antarctica that the ice core develops rather slowly. In Greenland, where there are other ice cores, it precipitates much more rapidly. We have a time scale resolution on the order of years. But there we're thwarted by another problem, which is that the carbon dioxide content is contaminated by dust and soot that blows off of North America and Eurasia and is gets into the air bubbles along with the carbon dioxide. How are the dates achieved? The dates are achieved at the upper portion of the ice core. You can actually see the annual layers of deposition. And then as it gets deeper and deeper, these things get compressed, and some effort is taken to extrapolate. So there is some uncertainty about date. But if we reparameterize this axis, though, it just would shift these patterns. It would distort those patterns together. So that wouldn't affect the correlation, because we're obtaining the temperature and the CO2 at the same time, even though we don't know exactly what time it is. Another thing to notice about this is here's our concentration of carbon dioxide. So this is the present, and the present's rather warm. This is the last ice age here, which ended around 10,000 years ago. So the temperature went back up. This is the period of civilization. So at the last point that was recorded in the ice core, concentration of CO2 is 280 parts per million. We now ask, where are we now as a result of industrialization? We're not at 300, 320, 340, 360. We're getting up to around here, way beyond where it's been in the past 100,000 years, in fact, way beyond where it's been in the past million years. Okay, so let's talk for a moment about how the temperature can be measured. All right. So, of course, this is really exercising quantum zero-point motion, which is why liquid helium never freezes, even at zero temperature. So in classical physics, of course, all motion ceases at absolute zero. Everything would freeze into a solid. But in quantum physics, in some sense, there's still motion at zero degrees. And we can think of that in some crude way. In a harmonic oscillator problem, we imagine having an atom that is bouncing off of another atom nearby. We'll just take that to be, in this case, a hard wall. Then there's going to be some natural oscillation frequency. but we know that the energy level is really 1/2 H times that frequency, and this is simply reflecting the uncertainty principle, which is that we can't localize the atom in position space and in momentum space simultaneously. So in helium-4, we have a particularly shallow well, and these quantum fluctuations are enough to keep the system in a liquid at all temperatures. Of course, for the heavier materials that are more strongly bound together, it will solidify, but the quantum corrections due to the fact that water containing O18 has less zero-point motion say that, therefore, O18 would be less likely to evaporate during a cold spell, for example. Right? Notice that this really is a quantum effect. It's not just the change in the attempt frequency, for example, because a change in the attempt frequency would also follow from the fact that the molecule is more massive. But if this system is in equilibrium, which is probably a reasonably good approximation, then the temp rate is not going to change the equilibrium balances. The only thing that can change the equilibrium ratios is changes in the energy, the free energy of these systems. And of course, this was pointed out by Urey back shortly after World War II. Okay, so that explains how we can use oxygen 18 as what's called a proxy for the temperature. Of course, I've oversimplified things considerably. There are some corrections having to do with the fact that there's some natural variations, spatial variations in the distribution of O18 in the different oceans. And so depending on where the water came from that ends up in the Antarctic ice, that can distort this record, depending on the actual flow of the air masses that bring precipitation to Antarctica. However, sorry, one other thing now that I want to turn to, now that I've finished my three examples of quantum mechanics, I'm now going to move to wave mechanics, which is unexplained so far. We see that there's this correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature, but we'd still like to gain some understanding about why is the Earth fluctuating in temperature like that? And a partial answer to that is now, we're pretty certain, provided by astronomy, which has some history, astronomical theory for the Ice Age. James Croll, a Scottish astronomer, tried to account for the Ice Ages in terms of the precession of the equinoxes and the changes in the orbital eccentricity of the Earth. And I'll define those in just a moment. Basically changes in the orbit of the Earth as it goes around the Sun. And this was formalized and made more precise by Milankovitch, who calculated the intensity of solar radiation that the Earth receives as a function of the latitude of the Earth and time. And he saw variation in summertime radiation at high latitudes as the main cause of the ice ages. The reason for that is the idea that the ice ages, the glaciers in the continental ice sheet would form in the polar regions, and therefore the intensity of sunlight and radiation at those high latitudes would control whether they form or not. This received very strong empirical support in the 70s by Imbri, who is an emeritus professor at Brown, and a number of other people, and this is accounted for in his book, and I'll tell you what that empirical evidence is in just a moment. So let's look at these astronomical variations. There's three principal ones. So here we have the Earth orbiting around the Sun. And the Earth's orbit is characterized by a number of different quantities. First of all, there are variations on the longest time scale of 100,000 years or so, which are caused by the interactions of the Earth's orbit with Jupiter and Saturn principally, which are the most massive planets in the solar system, which cause the eccentricity of the orbit to oscillate from more circular to more elliptical and back again. Secondly, there is the precession of the equinoxes, which all of you have calculated, I'm sure, in physics at some point, due to the torque exerted by the moon on the equatorial bulge of the Earth. And that occurs over a time scale of around 20,000 years. Finally, the tilt of the Earth's axis changes. Right now, right, it's at 22.5 degrees, but it changes, it oscillates slightly due to Jupiter and Saturn acting on the Earth. Now, of course, Jupiter and Saturn can't torque the Earth over, but what's happening is that the orbital plane of the Earth's orbit is not aligned precisely with the orbital plane of Jupiter. So Jupiter tends to pull up and down the Earth's orbital plane, and since the spin axis is fixed in space, that changes the relative degree of tilt of the spin axis with respect to the orbital plane, therefore changing the tilt of the Earth. And, of course, if the tilt is greater, the seasonal effects are larger. If the tilt is less, the seasonal effects are less. And that occurs with a period of roughly 41,000 years. Of course, none of these things are at a one pure frequency because it's quite a complicated problem to consider the influence of these of the Moon and the two Jovian planets on the Earth's motion. Okay, so if that's true, then if we take our data for the temperature of the Earth and take a Fourier transform of it, transform it into frequency space, we should see peaks at those three periods. And in fact, that's what we do. This is the here's the O18 concentration, in this case taken from mainly from ocean cores as part of this big collaboration. So we're looking at cores drilled in the ocean, which also provide a temporal record for the concentration of oxygen, 18 that's subsumed in the shells of plankton that fall on the bottom of the ocean. So that's in real time. As you can see, this record goes back about twice as long as the Vostok record, so it's a little bit nicer to deal with. And now we can Fourier transform it with the method of spectral analysis, which is simply a way of doing statistics in frequency space. What we do is we Fourier transform it, but we're going to, first, of course, we have to apply a smooth cutoff in time to the ends of this data. It doesn't suddenly just terminate, and we don't want high frequency noise leaking in coming from just saying, well, we only have data back to 250,000 years. Let's just take the temperature to zero at that point. So we'll smoothly cut it off, and then we'll compute the Fourier transform in the usual way, numerically with a fast Fourier transform. And we'll compute the power, which is basically this just the square of the coefficients. And then we have to average over some range of frequencies in order to gain statistical significance, because any one data point in time doesn't have any statistical weight. Similarly, one data point in frequency space doesn't have any statistical weight. We average over some range of frequencies. So if we take that data and Fourier transform it, this is what we get. So we have a peak here corresponding to around 20,000 years. That's the, we can identify that as our changes in the eccentricity of, no, sorry, the precession of the equinoxes. We have another change, another peak here at around 40,000 years. That was the change in the tilt. And the strongest contribution is at around 100,000 years due to the changes in eccentricity. Well, that's pretty convincing. And in fact, that shows up in analysis of many different cores, including that Vostok ice core I showed you. The one big loophole or one big problem for this theory is that if we actually calculate the changes in the intensity of the solar radiation due to these orbital changes, it's very small. And if we just plug those into our little calculation of the temperature of the Earth, we would not get the large enough swing to account for those ice ages. So the current thinking is that there are probably some positive feedback processes that are occurring that amplify that that temperature change. And you can easily see how that might occur. For example, if we cool the Earth, glaciers might form. As the glaciers form, they will reflect more light, causing more cooling, and so on. So that there's an idea that the Earth might exist between two sort of stable states, one without ice and one with lots of ice, and it can swing back and forth between those two. Okay, and also we also have some evidence from that Vostok core that carbon dioxide may be playing a role, perhaps as a positive feedback mechanism, changing the Earth's temperature. which now brings me to my final subject, which is what is going on today. So let's look at the carbon dioxide concentration over the past 1,000 years on the Earth. This is a compilation of various different data sources. Of course, towards the end, we have very precise work due to Charles Keeling in Hawaii, which I'll turn to in a moment. So you can see that this matches where we were on that Vostok scale of around 280 parts per million way back in the Middle Ages. And clearly, something is happening here, and that's the Industrial Revolution. We have this exponential increase in the concentration of carbon dioxide. Now we're not even, now we're up here or so. If we blow this up, then you can actually see, this data isn't so good, the effects of World War II cause a leveling off in the carbon dioxide for a while as the energy sources are disrupted. All right, so let's look at the more recent future, this beautiful compilation. I have to update. I'm sorry, I just had this up to 89. Starting from 1958, this is, again, the concentration of carbon dioxide. And we see this beautiful seasonal cycle, which is just due to the plants growing and dying back each year. It's not a perfect sine wave, but then the seasons aren't perfectly sinusoidal. It takes longer for the plants to, it takes a different amount of time for the plants to grow than to die. You can see my my weakness as a biologist. The northern hemisphere dominates this effect because almost all the land mass is in the northern hemisphere. Obviously, yes, there's a very strong asymmetry between the hemispheres. On top of that, there is a, of course, our exponentially increasing carbon dioxide due to the anthropogenic emissions. Let's just take the power spectrum of that. Just it's another illustration of our Fourier transforms. You can see we have this huge spike at 1 year, and then various harmonics due to the seasonal cycle not being a perfect sinusoid. All right, and now we can remove that seasonal cycle so that we can extract additional information not due to plants. And we get this, and there's still some interesting anomalies here. For those of you who were living here in 82 or so, you know that that was when the region was beset by these powerful El Nino-driven storms. And that had some effect on the carbon dioxide, which I want to explore now, because this is giving us some indication of a positive feedback process. That is that the Earth is sometimes warmer, sometimes cooler, just due to natural fluctuations, and the carbon dioxide is responding to that. Now, this isn't the greenhouse effect, because the changes in the carbon dioxide are quite small. They're not driving the temperature, but rather it's pretty clear that the reverse must be happening. So we can do that. We can learn about that by making a cross correlation between temperature and carbon dioxide over that time period. Basically, the idea is to take the Fourier transform of, say, the temperature and the carbon dioxide concentrations, multiply these two things together, and then average them over our little spectral window. And then if the two things are uncorrelated, their phases will be rapidly changing over different frequencies, and that quantity will average out to zero. But if they're correlated and in lockstep, then we'll get some non-zero result. And indeed, we see that there's an extremely strong correlation between those carbon dioxide fluctuations and temperature, especially if we look at global temperatures in, if we look at temperatures close to the equatorial regions. This is the coherency, that is a quantity that goes up to 1 if we had 100% correlation, versus frequency. Looking at that Keeling, Hawaii carbon dioxide data after the seasonal cycle has been removed, comparing it to different air temperatures, one in the southern region, one in the northern region, and then the solid line is averaging over the whole Earth, showing the strongest correlation over a range of frequencies. indicating that it's probably due to correlations between temperature in the equatorial regions and carbon dioxide. And we can verify that by looking, focusing just at the equatorial regions. And at the 99% confidence level, we see that there's a very strong correlation between both equatorial air temperature and carbon dioxide, and also sea surface temperature, temperature of the ocean measured independently of the air temperature, literally by ships that take buckets of water and measure the temperature of the ocean as they pass through different regions of the Earth. We see that there's a very strong correlation. And in fact, these peaks seem to correspond to the typical time period of 2 years and 3 years, which the El Nino often occurs. So this is a positive correlation, and in fact, we can describe some causality here, because by looking at the relative phase, we learn that temperature fluctuations precede the carbon dioxide fluctuations. And in fact, this work was picked up by the New York Times, where they took my figure, which was in centigrade, and converted it to these funny units for popular consumption. But you can see in time here, maybe more, perhaps a little bit less abstractly than in frequency space, that indeed there's a very strong correlation between the temperature and carbon dioxide. And so some of the El Nino events that occurred when the Santa Monica Pier was destroyed in the 80s were over here. So there seems to be a strong correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature, which is cause for alarm, because if there is greenhouse-induced warming, this could accelerate it.
Did you say that temperature fluctuations preceded?
Yes. Temperature fluctuations preceded the carbon dioxide fluctuations by a few months. Right. This isn't the greenhouse effect, this is the sort of reverse, but it could exacerbate the greenhouse effect, because if temperature warms, more CO2, more temperature, more CO2, and so on. There are many possible mechanisms that could be going on here. The most simplest one that comes to mind is the idea that as there's a lot of carbon dioxide dissolved in the ocean water, as the oceans get warmer, you might expect that carbon dioxide to go into the atmosphere. However, that's probably not what's happening here. Because an additional thing that happens during the El Nino, when the ocean water is warmer, is that we have this warm water layer on top, which tends to inhibit upwelling of water, which brings this carbon dioxide from depth, and therefore it tends to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that's released into the atmosphere. So that doesn't seem to be it. Other possible things are coral bleaching events, which have been occurring with alarming frequency. That is, when whole coral reefs die because the water temperature rises, that can release some carbon dioxide. Okay, so now let's turn finally to what exactly have the temperatures been doing since, say, the past 100 years or so. As I mentioned, the glaciers that are in California are melting and probably won't be around in 50 years or so. And in general, we have very strong indications of global warming occurring over the past 100 years. These are two separate compilations of surface air temperatures taken from weather stations around the world since the 1880s. There are lots of complications with combining these data, particularly the effect of growing cities causing a local warming due to asphalt going down. These two groups have tried to remove that from the data, and we see overall there is a positive trend. Here's a little bit more recent compilation. Last time I gave this talk last year, 1997 was the warmest year in the past, in this century. However, probably this time, once we finish with 1998, it will exceed 1997, because all of the months up to and including October have been world record months in global temperature. Each one, every January, if we compare this past January with all the previous Januaries over the past 100 years, it was warmest. Same with February, same with March, and so on. Okay, let's look at a little bit longer time scale. This was an effort to compile a bunch of different data records. You can see it's quite noisy. This uses tree rings, ice cores, all sorts of things over a longer time scale. We can see the temperature, if we believe this data, was relatively constant with some fluctuations and then has been going up in the last century. The sea level is rising, which you might expect as the glaciers melt. Since the past 100 years, this is the sea level increasing in centimeters. Glaciers are melting. This glacier here, many of you probably know, is one very close to the physics school in Les Ouches, France, and it's melting. The glaciers in California are melting. Just recently, in most recent Nature, we have yet another attempt to extract the temperature of the Earth over the past few hundred years, a very clever idea. This uses the idea that we can drill boreholes into the Earth and that the heat, the temperature of the Earth diffuses slowly through the rock, so we can deconvolve that. It's an inverse problem of solving the diffusion equation. And this represents the result of that, showing a warming when globally averaged up to the present time. This is just one of those temperature records that I just showed you for comparison. I guess the point is that that is constant and should be in equilibrium. So the sources of heat, you know, on these timescales are, you know, it's coming up.
After you're only doing this once, you're measuring the temperature of the function at depth, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And then you're deconvolving that as thermal diffusion from the surface. But
right. Yeah, but I think if, say, this air temperature of the Earth were constant, then since so much time has passed since the formation of the Earth, we would expect that there's some constant gradient in temperature. And now we're looking at some spatial variation superimposed on top of it. I haven't gone through the details of this deconvolution. Obviously, it's important. All of these methods suffer from various defects. It's important to try to look at as many different sources of information as possible. One other thing that we can, which is rather disturbing, that we can actually see if we go back to that carbon dioxide data from that Keeling has compiled, even just by looking directly at that, we can see that something funny is happening. Let's just go back to that seasonal cycle. If you look carefully at this, you might notice that the amplitude of the seasonal cycle has been increasing with time. If you compare back here in the early 60s to now, this has the most reasonable explanation in the idea that the growing season has increased in length due to global warming and is therefore causing larger swings in the carbon dioxide because plants have larger time to grow in the spring. So all of these things are rather consistent and pointing to the fact that there is indeed a warming of the Earth's surface. And the question is whether that's caused by carbon dioxide that human beings have put up. That seems quite plausible because if we go back over a few hundred years before the Industrial Revolution, we saw that, if you believe some of these reconstructions, the temperature was fairly constant and is only now starting to shoot up. And indeed, if we know, we can now return to our original calculation of the Earth's temperature. And let's look at that plot again of the concentration of, or the absorption of infrared radiation, if I can find it. Here we go. So we saw that if we integrate this, we can rather rapidly come to the conclusion that present carbon dioxide contribution is resulting in maybe a 7 degree Celsius increase in the Earth's temperature, concentration of the carbon dioxide in the industrial period has gone from 280 parts per million to maybe 370 parts per million. Therefore, we would expect a couple degrees Celsius change in the temperature. And although that's a very crude calculation, it's probably just as good as the most complicated Cray-based calculation you can do, because the length and time scales in the problem are so enormous that it's impossible to model things such as the global climate simultaneously with the physics of the formation of, say, a cumulonimbus clouds. So in particular, there's at least 14 orders of magnitude of length scale on a two-dimensional, two plus one-dimensional, well, you know, two-dimensional region plus a couple kilometers in the vertical direction. There's long time scales, so it's sort of hopeless to do a direct simulation. so this is one of the problems leading to in trying to model this effect. We know another question is the effect of clouds on the feedback. We might expect that as the Earth warms, there'd be more clouds, and more clouds would reflect light, and that would be a negative feedback compensating for the greenhouse effect. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. One reason is that if you form more cumulus clouds, that would indeed happen. But also, you tend to form more cirrus clouds, the high wispy clouds that are very efficient at trapping in infrared radiation, but allowing visible light through. We can decide that by simply looking at the Earth at different times when it's naturally warmer and cooler by these fluctuations, and just looking at the infrared radiations escaping back through space. Some very clever satellite experiments have done that. But we can reason that conclusion in a very simple-minded way in the following, with the following argument, which is simply to observe that the relative humidity of your everyday life, say here in Santa Barbara, does not change so much when it gets warmer. In fact, here, I would venture to guess that the relative humidity drops in the summer and increases in the winter. And the relative humidity is a measure of the likelihood, in some sense, of cloud formation. So if we have warming, at least in Santa Barbara, we expect to have even more clear days, more radiation coming in, warming up things further. In the East Coast, I think it'd be more correct to say that the humidity is relative humidity is relatively constant, 100% all of the time, which I still haven't adapted to after 15 years. Okay, other complications which I haven't mentioned are dust, soot, aerosols, hazes. Industrial pollution causes soot particles, which can enhance cloud formation. Also, there are volcanic eruptions. Probably the reason the temperature is going up so rapidly in these past couple of years is that dust from Mount Pinatubo, the volcano in the Philippines, has now finally rained out of the atmosphere and is no longer providing that cooling effect that may have been masking the greenhouse effect. I haven't talked much about the ocean. The ocean is, of course, coupled to the atmosphere. And some prominent atmospheric scientists think that the ocean offers the potential for nasty surprises. In particular, there could be a sudden change in the circulation of the ocean, such as the Gulf Stream, is driven in large part by changes in the salinity of water in the ocean, which changes its density and therefore causes a flow of water from at different depths, making this sort of conveyor belt that goes around the world transporting heat, keeping Europe warm during the winter. But if there's global warming, then the distribution of precipitation may change. That could also shut off, some people think, some of the ocean circulation. There's another possibility of additional complication, which is fluctuations in the solar output. Counterintuitively, the sun is warmer when there are sunspots. Even though the sunspots appear as dark regions on the sun, they're surrounded by brighter regions, and the net result is overall increasing brightness. Right now, we're in the solar minimum, so we expect the sun's a little bit dimmer than usual, so that can't account for the past couple years' increase in the warmth of the Earth. In any case, the upshot, at least in my mind, is that both simple and complex models typically say that a doubling of carbon dioxide, which would occur sometime in the next century at our present consumption rates, will cause a rise in the temperature by a few degrees Celsius. Now, probably a lot of you received this pseudo National Academy of Science preprint, which was put out by Seitz and some of his collaborators last year. And it, among other things, says that, well, first of all, he questions the whole idea that there is any global warming. He cites this evidence that I presented of a strong feedback between temperature and carbon dioxide as evidence that the greenhouse effect isn't occurring, which, as I've argued, is doesn't make any sense because the magnitude of the carbon dioxide fluctuations are too small. It's really a separate thing happening. It's a feedback mechanism. He also, well, one of the main points was that he said that there was a disagreement between satellite measurements of the Earth's temperature versus these surface air temperature measurements, which I've mainly been focusing on. But recently, in fact, the satellites did seem to show that there was some small cooling in the Earth's atmosphere. But recently, it's been discovered that there was something overlooked in that satellite data, which is simply that the satellite orbit is decaying over time and has sunk by a few kilometers. So when that's taken into account, the satellite data comes into relatively good agreement with the surface air temperature data and all the other data I've mentioned, and it seems that there's definitely some global warming occurring. So to my mind, though, it isn't necessary to establish this greenhouse effect with 100% certainty, since in any case we're carrying out the experiment and the consequences of global warming, which I haven't really gone into, are severe. That maybe just the fact that these simple arguments indicate that there's a problem combined with the fact that the consequences are so severe somehow tells us that we shouldn't insist on a completely 100% certain scientific answer to this extremely complicated problem, but should take some action now to stop the experiment. So I'll leave you with this cartoon, which sort of sums up how I feel about it. Thank you.